not connected to nature, but instead we're benefiting from the conveniences of our society that has like exploited nature. And this isn't to say that that's good, that exploitation is good, just that it might be good for us, that maybe living apart from nature, benefiting from you know, all the conveniences of a large city, for instance, might be something that is just objectively better, a better way for a human being to live, just better for us as individuals. There's also the consideration that it might be better for nature to live that way. Because, you know, as some of us probably are aware, like, when more people go to national parks, those national parks degrade. There's a negative impact on the park and on the ecosystem the more, like, large of a traffic jam there is in Yellowstone because someone saw a deer. Like, that's not necessarily a good thing for Yellowstone to be out and for individuals to go out and connect to nature. It might be better instead, if we care about the environment, to stay in that large city with all of our modern conveniences and simply provide all of our resources to environmental nonprofits that are working to restore national parks or like backpedal the effects of climate change or invest in alternative medicine, so, or alternative energy. And so it's just an important consideration. And now I, despite those considerations, like, I believe it is worthwhile both for us and for nature to work on that personal connection to nature, and investment in an identification with the natural world. But it's worth taking those sort of questions and counterpoints seriously. And so in order to do that, I mean, that question of if we should reconnect to nature can be split into two other, like, more specific questions, which is it good for us and is it good for nature, as we've already sort of mentioned. And in order to help answer those two questions, there's two, like, I guess, philosophy vocabulary words that would be pretty useful that are at least, I mean, there's many ways to answer that question, but I think today Ryan and I are going to approach it through the lens of phenomenology and pragmatism, which are two schools of philosophy, two methodologies in philosophy, two lenses, I guess, for asking questions or lining questions up in a certain kind of way. And so to start with, phenomenology is a description of the qualitative experience of consciousness. So you could have, for instance, a phenomenology of food, which is a description of what are the qualities of being part of the process of ingestion and consumption. What is it like? Phenomenology asks the question, what is something like? Other schools of philosophy, like metaphysics, for instance, ask the question, what is out there in reality? What is reality made of? You know, ethics asks, like, how should we act? What should we do? Phenomenology asks, what is this like? And some phenomenologists get really obscure with this. I mean, like, Heidegger is a phenomenologist whose whole project was, what is it like to be? Which you can imagine that gets pretty complicated very quickly. But you can have a phenomenology of anything that's just sort of a description of what the conscious experience of that thing is like. And phenomenologies are useful because when you discover, you know, they can be validated by an individual. So, like, you know, you could hear someone describing what the phenomenology of food is, for instance, and be like, ah, yes, like, I hadn't considered it that way before, but when I reflect on my own experience, I can validate that and say, that is what eating food is like, and that could give insight into how perhaps we should change our eating of food, how perhaps, you know, what it shares in common with other sort of experiences that we have. And so that can be, like, so a phenomenology is useful in order to, like, making decisions about how we understand our experience of the world. And so in regards to that question of nature, we're gonna talk about, at later stops, the project of a sort of new movement in phenomenology called ecophenomenology, which focuses on what is the experience of being in the natural world, of being, more generally, a human being that is an animal that is a part of the natural world. What aspects of that have we lost touch with? What aspects of that are worth emphasizing? What aspects of that might we be missing for our own quality of experience of the world? What might be important to us? And this asks the question of what's the benefit to us? What might be important for us to re-enliven in ourselves? The second term, pragmatism, this is a philosophical tradition that's mostly American that focuses on, I guess, the idea of truth. It sort of gets rid of the idea that truth is something out there objective that we can know for sure, that can be applied universally to all different sorts of circumstances, Pragmatism instead equates truth with function, with basically with usefulness. Like something is like a belief, and I think beliefs are the most relevant thing to talk about here in regards to pragmatism. William James is a early 20th century American pragmatist who argued that our beliefs about the world can be evaluated as good or bad based on how well they work, how well they do what they set out to do, how useful they are for our experience of navigating the world. And so pragmatism is a little different from other kind of areas of philosophy that get rid of the idea of truth, like relativism, because for a relativist, what my truth is, what your truth is, you can't judge one as better than another. Whereas for pragmatism, even though there still is no absolute truth out there that we can somehow discover, there is this notion that we can evaluate what beliefs are better or worse based on how well they work and how well they set out to do, how well they do what they set out to do, basically. So for instance, a belief system that encourages charity and encourages goodwill towards people and encourages ethical action would be considered more true, more worthwhile to pursue than one that is technically more accurate about the facts of objective reality, or that might better reflect our understanding of those facts actively, that doesn't encourage that sort of behavior, that doesn't encourage a sort of way of living that is functional for us to live in long term. And so that's going to be useful when we examine animism, which is a orientation towards the world that ecophenomenologists talk about and that other people discuss, and that we're going to discuss as sort of being a belief system that has a pragmatic use for this particular time and place and for us as human beings living in nature that is beneficial to the way we act towards nature, and that also arises from personal connection to nature. So so that's a sort of layout of how we're going to be talking about things. Please, yes.
So what's the scope of how you evaluate those things? Because you could say from a pragmatic perspective, capitalism is great if you're viewing it from the 1%, and maybe not so great for the rest of us. So, you know, if it's evaluated from a personal perspective, then everybody's going to have a slightly different viewpoint, and how do you unify those or have some sort of universal scope?
That's a good question, and it's not an easy question. And it's one of those things that I feel like I think that as far as, you know, to use the example of capitalism, it doesn't. I mean, a lot of the critiques of capitalism are that it doesn't work. It doesn't function like it's supposed to. It's not supposed to benefit only. I mean, it is supposed to, because that's like. but the ideology of capitalism is not supposed to only benefit people at the top. It's supposed to benefit everybody within the system through like a sort of trickle down sort of. And we know from looking at the way that our society is structured that it's not working in what it sets out to do. So I think it can be evaluated as like, as false in that sort of schema. But it is a good question though, because from the individual perspective, it is working. And I think that that's one of those things where, and I am not as familiar with pragmatism as I am with phenomenology, so I might be, I might not be answering this as fully as I could, but I feel that maybe a pragmatist might avoid the comparison between like individual experiences, because that's sort of, you have to stand away to look at how it works with each person, and so it does end up being a personal evaluation of that. And the idea, I guess, would be if it's not working for most people and they recognize it, and it is working for a few people and they recognize it, that most people would be encouraged to sort of restructure that to work best for the most amount of people, but it would sort of be something that originates on the personal level for everybody. So yeah, it might be working for those people, but it wouldn't be working overall, and so it would change, or should change, I guess.
I think I would chime in too, that there's not necessarily one like unifying definition of pragmatism. There's different variations of pragmatism, different thinkers have had their different spin on it. And this notion of truth as usefulness can be controversial. In fact, I was just listening to a podcast recently that was addressing this very question, and the question of whether the science that led to the development of the atomic bomb is that science true? And from the one perspective, the perspective that Henry kind of laid out, you could argue that it's not, because it's harmful to humanity. It's not, in fact, useful to humanity to have this knowledge in our power. But another way of viewing it, I think, that still meshes from a pragmatic point of view, is that it's useful for the predetermined ends that we set out. So we investigated the atom mm-hmm. in order to produce this technology, and as a result, we created it. And so it, because it confirmed and helped us achieve the goals that we set for ourselves, it is true from a pragmatic point of view. But I don't know that there's...
So you're saying
I don't want to go off on a tangent, but I have a lot of problems with that. So we'll just let that one slide for right now.
One of the arguments in reconnecting with nature is that you love and protect things that you're familiar with. And mm-hmm. I know when I read an article about some disaster in the world, if I have friends or acquaintances who are of that ethnic group, I'm much more empathetic to their plight of hurricanes or floods or whatever than I am if I don't have any familiarity with that ethnic group. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I lay that across the nature consideration. And so can we be empathetic towards nature if we see pictures of it? For example, so we live in our high rise, but we have a beautiful scene of Yellowstone mm-hmm. in our living room. Is that enough, or do we need to go to Yellowstone once in a while and actually view it and smell it and hear it and feel it? And that's a big question.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point, and that's one of the major criticisms I have of this. There's a school of sort of environmental thought that's environmental ethics that's responding to the Anthropocene and responding to our effect on nature that called eco-modernism, and the sort of the ideology of eco-modernism is that we should really de-emphasize the personal connection to nature. We should live mm-hmm. as much disconnected from it as we can so that we can protect nature, so that we can minimize our impact completely, like synthesize our own food, just like use like, you know, just really just have a higher density of human population, maybe go to space and make Earth a nature preserve. Like that is and my one of my major criticisms of it, and this is a criticism a lot of people have, is basically what you said, which is like, yeah, you could be, you know, the example you used earlier, you could be living in the city and giving all your money to environmental nonprofits, but what's motivating you to care about that? Like, why would you do that unless you had some personal connection? And also, how could you trust those people who are supposedly, like, protecting nature? Like, that idea of, like, if we're living in a higher density and just to protect nature, why would they do that if no one had a connection to it?
Yeah.
Why, like, it would so easily, I think, go off the rails very quickly when people would be like, oh, why are we not exploiting all these resources? If they're just seeing it as resources because they're not... don't have a personal connection to it, who decided 50 years ago we should waste all this space? Let's just, you know, none of us remember why it matters, so let's just, let's exploit it. Like, so I think that's a really good, mm-hmm. really good point to make.
I mean, there are a lot of people who donate to Yellowstone Park Foundation from around the world who have never seen the park. Mm-hmm. I mean, so they have some connection through photographs.
Yeah.
They care about it, but... I don't know.
You know, and what I've, working in the nonprofit conservation world, you know, it's really been evident to me that, the personal connection, I mean, everybody who's in a nonprofit has had, you know, they tell you about those first experiences, you know, they're camping or whatever, or looking mm-hmm. at spiders in their backyard. I mean, that's just universal. And I've lost my name. but anyway, yeah, so I guess back to what you were saying, there would be, if we did not have that, I'm totally convinced we would exploit every inch that we can,
mm-hmm.
because there's the basic human nature of people that is to gather things around them and to gather money around them, and at least in our system, that seems to be, maybe it's not basically human, but it's basically part of our culture for sure, and many other cultures on the earth. And so, yeah, I would feel like, I mean, I work toward getting as many people to connect with nature as possible, because it seems like that's the only way that we can ever have a chance. There'd be no reason that mm-hmm. anybody would have put aside national parks or mm-hmm. wilderness areas.
I just read
absolutely.
Yesterday in the Independent Record a guest editorial, And, you know, this person obviously had their own agenda, but they had some connection with forest management, and they were basically complaining that there's a lot of political backlash against protecting wilderness, that we're wasting resources. Mm-hmm. And in this article, this man pointed out that there were lots and lots of forest that was put up for bid to be harvested that did not sell because there's no market for the trees right now. Hmm. And that didn't have any, that fact didn't stop politically the you know, a certain political group from, you know, still blaming those, you know, those hippie environmentalists, and they're locking it up for their, you know, snail darters and their spotted owls.
Yeah.
And you know, when it's more complicated than that, and you know, I don't know, I just thought that was really enlightening to me, to, and also you sort of know it, but to know that, yeah, it's
downhill or come
there are there are complicated market forces involved in those things too, and you know, which I always equate to fashion. Mm. That times change, you know, and you know what people want to do 10 years apart, you know, is different. What you know, what's the thing that is the most popular?
Yeah, I think that I mean, that's the point. It reminded me of this story about this lumber baron in British Columbia who I think was the governors of provinces are called in Canada.
Premier.
What is it?
Premier.
Premier, yeah. He was the premier of British Columbia for a little bit too, but he was also a lumber baron. And he has this line where, you know, they have like these big like lumber fields, and he was rushing to chop down all the trees because, quote, sooner or later in 20 years they're going to have an alternative to paper that's cheaper, and we're just going to be stuck here with all these trees. And that, I mean, that says a lot. Like, there's just much in that to unpack about like capitalism, well, about the fashions that you're talking about. I mean, yeah.
Well, certainly that is definitely an issue with carbon. Mm-hmm. That, you know, why is it that the status quo, or the, you know, the powers that be, or the 1% or whoever it is that is, you know, resisting, you know, and paying off scientists and all those kinds of things that we know are going on, why are they doing that and resisting sustainable? And it's because they have the oil and they want to get all the money while it's still worth a lot of money, and in you know, it won't be, you know, in some point, because things will change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing I was going to add too, just with the personal connection conversation that a couple of you had mentioned, I always go back to a line that I'm a huge fan of by Jack Turner, and the idea of that basically says we only protect what we love, and we only love what we know. I think I have that down.
Okay,
so yeah, I just think there's something really powerful about that, and the connection with education and knowing, and what does it mean to know? And maybe that's something we'll kind of explore a little bit on some of the next stops, this idea of the being in nature and that inputs.